Hey, everybody. It is Wednesday, March 6th. You're listening to the Mo News Podcast. It's Mo Shwanunu here. This is the place where we bring you just the facts and read all the news and read between the lines so you don't have to. As you can probably tell, it's just me today. We're giving Jill the day off if you've been listening the past couple days. You've heard her voice. It definitely needs a break. So we're giving it a break for 24 hours. Jill, we hope you come back strong and feeling better tomorrow. Wishing you a quick recovery. So it'll just be me today as we deal with the aftermath of Super Tuesday and the rest of the day's news. All right, and now to the headlines. Super Tuesday elections were held yesterday in almost a third of the country. More than a dozen states and territories voted as expected. Trump and Biden dominated last night, though Nikki Haley won a state. We'll tell you which one, as did a Democratic businessman named Jason Palmer. We'll explain who he is and where he beat Joe Biden last night. We'll tell you the latest on the massive global social media outage yesterday that hit all Meta properties, Facebook down, Instagram down. Gave me a break for a couple hours yesterday. We'll have the latest. A potentially new tactic for the Houthi rebels in Yemen, as several cables that run the Red Sea to connect the internet between Europe and Asia are cut. New concerns from scientists about how soon the Arctic may be ice-free for months on end. We'll tell you about it. In Washington, we'll have the latest on the healthcare hack, how the government is stepping in, and new suspicions that millions in ransom may have been paid to one of the ransomware attackers. A new push to unionize college athletes who say they want their fair share of the money they bring into colleges. And the latest in royal news, Princess Kate, new photos this week. Her mystery surgery continues to stoke speculation months later. And of course, I'll bring you On This Day in History. But let's get started here with Super Tuesday results, at least what we know as of early Wednesday morning. 15 states voted yesterday, as well as the territory of American Samoa. Not much in the way of surprises. Trump and Biden dominating, as nearly a third of the country went to the polls yesterday from coast to coast. And we are closer than ever now to a repeat of the 2020 election. Trump and Biden are now as close to a sure thing as you can get, as both men are just a few delegates away from wrapping up their party's nominations. We expect that to happen over the course of the next week or two. As of this recording, Trump appears to have won 14 of the 15 states that voted in the GOP primary yesterday. That includes Texas, California, Virginia, Tennessee, Oklahoma, Colorado, Alabama, Arkansas, Massachusetts, Maine, Minnesota. You get the point. Now, Nikki Haley did deprive him of a clean sweep last night. She won in the state of Vermont. That's a state that has a particularly large moderate Republican population. She campaigned there, and she pulled off what is her second victory overall. She won in Washington, D.C. in their GOP primary over the weekend, Vermont being her second win. Nonetheless, though, Trump taking a giant leap last night, dominating across the country. Many of those states, winner-take-all states when it comes to delegates for the GOP convention. So he is now set to lock in the nomination in a matter of a week or so. Speaking at Mar-a-Lago last night, the former president, making no mention of Haley, spent a lot of his time focused on criticizing Joe Biden and talking about the need to unify the Republican Party. Take a listen.
We have a great Republican Party with tremendous talent, and we want to have unity, and we're going to have unity.
So that was Trump. Haley choosing not to speak last night, not being very visible after effectively being dominated by Trump there across the country. On CNN last night, Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, who knows Nikki Haley well but has been a supporter of Trump here all along, says that it is time for her to endorse Trump, to end her campaign and be a, quote, team player. It is unclear what she does next. She has been increasingly critical of Trump of late. She has nothing else to do right now, so no urgency to leave the campaign. A lot of bad blood here between her and Trump. Her negatives continue to go higher in the Republican Party. So it's unclear what future she has in the GOP after this. They don't like each other, so it would be a real shocker if somehow he was to choose her as the VP. Also, don't expect her to run as a third party candidate, given how challenging that is. So sort of for now, it's a zombie campaign for Nikki Haley, as she sort of just continues to do what she's doing, criticize Trump and wait for a miracle. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, Joe Biden won overwhelmingly last night in every single state that was called across the country. We are watching just a couple things. First, the uncommitted vote. Remember in Michigan last week, about 100,000 people, just about 13% of the population voted uncommitted, meaning they're just unhappy with Joe Biden and decided to go with the none of the above option that's available on the ballot. So we've been watching that because that is an indication of concerns, particularly progressives, younger voters, Arab voters have about Joe Biden, specifically regarding his policy, his foreign policy regarding Israel and Gaza, saying he's too supportive of Israel. So you've seen a movement among some younger and progressive voters to use the uncommitted option where it's available to register their discontent with Joe Biden. So that was something we were watching last night after the 13% voted uncommitted in Michigan last week. Well, in Minnesota, they reached nearly 20% of the vote uncommitted. That's where there is a large population of younger people, progressives, and Somali population of Muslims. There's a big push among them to vote uncommitted last night. In North Carolina, it appears to have reached 12% of voters who voted no preference. Massachusetts, about 9%. So in a couple of those states, Minnesota and North Carolina in particular, and Michigan last week, that means that there will be a couple no preference or uncommitted delegates at the convention in Chicago. That's where the DNC will be held this summer, meaning you're going to hear a debate. You're going to hear a small debate among the handful of uncommitted delegates who will say their piece, who registered their unhappiness with Biden and his foreign policy. So that's something to watch. And as I promised in the headlines, a fun result from American Samoa. Now, Biden won every single state, but there's also the territory. That's a few islands out in the Pacific of American Samoa. They assigned 6 delegates. And the results there, out of 91 ballots cast, again, 91 ballots, a guy named Jason Palmer, a previously unknown candidate, got 51 of those 91 ballots, Joe Biden winning 40 ballots, which means Jason Palmer, a Baltimore businessman who works in tech, who's never visited American Samoa before, won the American Samoa caucus. He told the Washington Post he's been doing Zooms, talking to people, listening to their concerns. He apparently has also invested $500,000 of his own money running for president. I have to be honest, as someone who covers the news on a daily basis, I had not heard of Jason Palmer, but he has won American Samoa, which means he has won 4 delegates. Joe Biden has won 2 delegates based on those votes. A reminder, U.S. territories like American Samoa, like Guam, do vote in the primaries, but do not have representation in the Electoral College. So this is pretty much it. And fun fact, back in 2020, remember Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, ran for president, spent about $1 billion on his campaign. The only place he won, American Samoa. So it is known for unique results out there in the Pacific. Beyond the presidential race, there were hundreds of other primaries decided last night at the congressional and state levels. A couple that will get some notice today. In California, it now appears that Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff and Republican Steve Garvey, he's a former baseball player, were the top 2 vote getters for the California Senate seat. This was the seat that for decades belonged to Dianne Feinstein before she passed away. And it is an open primary this year. The top 2 vote getters go to the general election in the fall. So that again is Democratic Adam Schiff. You might have heard of him, the congressman, as well as Republican Steve Garvey. Given how Democratic California is, Schiff virtually guaranteed to be the next U.S. senator from California. In Texas, this is a Senate race we'll be watching in the fall. Colin Allred won the Democratic Senate primary. He'll be going up against Senator Ted Cruz in the fall. Now, no Democrat has won a Senate race in Texas since the 80s, but this is going to be an important race for Democrats. Cruz is viewed as somewhat vulnerable here. Now, Texas is still a pretty red state, but Ted Cruz is not very well liked, even among some Republicans in the state. So Democrats think they have a shot at taking him down this cycle. Colin Allred is a civil rights attorney, but you might also recognize his name because he's a former linebacker for the Tennessee Titans. He's been a congressman out of Dallas until now, and now is running for Senate. And he is running in Texas, which means he has been critical of Biden on a few different matters. He's running as a moderate here, including how Biden has handled the border. Of course, Texas being the epicenter of that border fight right now. We'll have much more in the way of results on the Mo News Instagram feed today as we get more and more, especially from the West Coast. California is a particularly slow counting state. We'll also look for other interesting anecdotes, trends, and reactions, as well as what Nikki Haley does next. So we'll bring you all that on the Instagram feed. All right, we have a lot more news to get to, including today's speed read. But first, I want to thank our big sponsor this week, Factor Meals. We're definitely pressed for time in our house, and I still want to eat healthy, nutritious meals. And that's why I'm so excited about Factor, America's number 1 ready-to-eat meal delivery service. So the thing about Factor is you can pick your meals. They get delivered to your door. You put them in the fridge, and typically you can heat them up in a couple minutes and they're ready to go. And they're not just your, you know, parents' frozen meals from the grocery store. They are chef prepared, dietitian approved, ready to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I've been loving them lately. I take them to work with me to the Mo News headquarters, and they often serve as my lunch. You get to skip, you know, preparing meals or the more expensive, you know, delivery or picking up a sandwich around the corner. And so there's the convenience factor, the cost factor, but also the nutritional factor. You get the nutritional quality you need. There's 35 plus weekly meals to choose from. It's flexible. You get as many meals as you want, as few meals as you want. And you can also pause and reschedule deliveries at any time. So check them out. Factormeals.com/MoNews50. Again, that is Factor, F-A-C-T-O-R, meals.com, factormeals.com/MoNews50 for 50% off. Again, that is 50% off. I definitely think it's worth a try. All right, now time for today's speed read. We begin with this from the Wall Street Journal. Many of you may have noticed yesterday the social media outage, Instagram, Facebook, Facebook Messenger, Threads, if some of you are still on Threads. And it was out for some people for more than 2 hours yesterday between 10 a.m. and noon Eastern time. Well, service has now been restored after a global outage yesterday that impacted many of Meta's platforms. It actually meant that I returned to Twitter yesterday for a bit. For a few of you who also follow me over there, I know they're calling it X these days. So I was covering it over there because, of course, many of you who turned to Instagram to figure out what was happening, there was nowhere to go. Just a frozen picture. You couldn't pull up your own account. You couldn't pull up messages. You couldn't post anything. It was a struggle there for a couple of hours. Not many details right now from the folks at Meta as to what transpired yesterday. What we have learned from Andy Stone, a spokesperson over there, he writes, a technical issue caused people to have difficulty accessing some of our services. We resolved the issue as quickly as possible for everyone who was impacted, and we apologize for the inconvenience. So as you can hear there, not much in the way of detail. The Biden administration, federal officials were asked whether there were credible threats, given it was Super Tuesday yesterday, whether this was a cyber hack. No evidence so far, no comment on that. But it does come a week after that AT&T outage, which was a separate technical issue at a separate company. But it did reinforce a lot of speculation from a number of you about whether the events were connected and this is a larger issue. Again, no evidence of that. We should note glitches do happen, especially on Meta platforms where there's more than 3 billion people, nearly half of Earth, use Facebook, Instagram, Messenger, WhatsApp. So a lot of room there for potential glitches, someone to hit the wrong button, the wrong software update. So we'll await details from the folks at Meta as to what transpired here. The last time we saw an outage like this was about 3 years ago, back in 2021. There was a 6-hour outage. Some of you might remember, most of us, I don't even remember that one. But it did mean this latest outage that a number of us turned to the other platforms, LinkedIn, TikTok, Twitter X. And so Twitter X was poking fun at everyone who suddenly came back to the platform yesterday, writing, "We know why you're all here right now," the owner Elon Musk weighing in. "If you're reading this post, it's because our servers are working." A reminder yesterday, of course, to continue to follow this podcast, follow our newsletter over at mo.news/newsletter, as well as our account over on Twitter. It's just the same as Instagram, at Moshe, at M-O-S-H-E-H. Should there be another Meta issue in the future and you're looking for some background as to what is happening? All right, next up here in the speed read, another outage, but not related to yesterday's outage. This from the Associated Press. 3 cables under the Red Sea that provide global internet and telecommunications have been cut as the waterway remains a target of the Houthi rebels in Yemen. The Red Sea, you might know, separates Africa from the Arabian Peninsula. Yemen is right there. That's where they've been attacking. The Houthis have a number of ships over the past few months, but this was a new one. Multiple lines under the Red Sea were cut. The Red Sea route is crucial for data moving between Asia and Europe. Internet traffic, many of you might not know, but our internet is based on these lines that run on the bottom of the ocean, these cables that run from the Americas to Europe, the Americas to Africa. And then you have this connection between Europe and Asia that runs under the Red Sea. What cut the lines remains unclear. There have been concerns about the cables being targeted by the Houthi campaign, which has mainly been above water until now. In early February, the internationally recognized government in Yemen, this is the government in exile that we recognize, but has effectively been booted from the capital and most of Western Yemen by the Houthis. They warned that the Houthis were planning to attack the internet cables. The lines appear to have been cut back on February 24th. It remains unclear how the Houthis could have cut the undersea cables here. The rebels are not known for their diving skills or salvage capability to target the lines, which sit, by the way, several hundred yards below the surface of the waterway. However, subsea cables can be cut by anchors, including those dropped from ships that have been disabled in attacks. So a drifting ship with its anchor could have been scraping the sea. That could have been a culprit. So it could have been an accident, or it could have been purposeful here by the Houthis. Now, the Houthis are saying they had nothing to do with it, and they do like to claim many of their attacks. So you can give them a little bit of credence, given that they do like to take credit for most things. But still, it does come as they've been attacking ship after ship after ship, and really trying to say they're trying to cripple the Western economy while the war between Israel and Hamas continues. For background here, we talked about three cables being cut. There are a total of 14 cables that run under the Red Sea. There's actually six more planned in the coming months and years. 90% of internet traffic between Asia and Europe flow through those Red Sea cables. Thankfully, there's a lot of redundancy there. So there were some intermittent outages, including in the country of Djibouti there on the African coast. But for the most part, most internet traffic was able to be rerouted through those redundant cables. Staying in the Middle East here for a second, talks continued in Cairo yesterday for a six-week ceasefire hostage deal between Israel and Hamas, though it is not clear at this point as we head into this week. We're just a couple days from the Muslim holy day of Ramadan that a deal will be signed by the start of Ramadan. That was the goal. The Americans were particularly pushing this, President Biden saying that he's very concerned about this war continuing during the Ramadan holiday because of heightened tensions there and many Muslims heading to pray for the next month. Here's a bit of what President Biden had to say on Tuesday. Forgive the background noise here. He was boarding a plane as he was asked questions by the media.
It's in the hands of Hamas right now. The Israelis have been cooperating. There's an offer out there. It's rational. We don't know what they're calling.
So again, hard to hear there on the tarmac, but effectively, the message from the White House yesterday was this is in the hands of Hamas right now. The Israelis are cooperating, have made a rational, cooperative deal here, and Hamas needs to respond here and effectively agree to the deal. What do we know about the deal so far? It entails far more aid for Gaza, 6 weeks of stoppage in fighting, hundreds of Palestinian prisoners from Israeli prisons that will be freed, including, by the way, a number of people who've murdered Israelis and belong to Hamas. So the Israelis feel they're giving more than enough here for what is reportedly going to be 40 hostages that are still being held in Gaza. A reminder, that's about a third of the hostages that remain in Gaza. 130 right now still remain in Gaza. Majority of those, the Israelis believe to be alive. A couple dozen of those, they believe to be just the remains of people who were killed by Hamas, whether on October 7th or afterward. And Hamas is holding on to their remains right now as part of a deal. It came as a senior Israeli minister, Benny Gantz, was in Washington in the last couple of days. One of three members, Gantz is, of Netanyahu's war cabinet, making all the key decisions. Though he did so in defiance, the trip was in defiance of Netanyahu. Gantz traveled to the U.S. showing a bit of independence here. A reminder, he's a rival of Netanyahu. He's a slightly more centrist, moderate minister. Many Israelis view him as the next prime minister when elections are held after the war. And he decided to come to the U.S. on his own without permission of Netanyahu. But he did so facing very harsh criticism and a lot of tough questions from Vice President Kamala Harris, from National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan in the U.S. The reports are right now that he got a very cold reception, a lot of questions about the path ahead, a lot of questions about whether they could actually pursue their planned invasion of Rafah, that is the major southern city in Gaza where the majority of Hamas fighters remain. The Israelis say that they can't complete the war without taking Rafah, though they have been able to eliminate the majority of Hamas's units. They can't leave those units behind in Rafah. The problem for them, more than 1.5 million Palestinian civilians that are right now displaced in Rafah. The U.S. officials telling the Israelis, what are you going to do with all those people? Asking a lot of questions. I found some reporting from reporter Barak Ravid, notable yesterday. He's a Israeli reporter with really some incredible sources inside the Israeli government. Fair warning here on language, because an Israeli official told him, again, language warning here, if you want to forward ahead, that they realized how much deep shit, quote, deep shit they are in with the U.S. government. They didn't realize it going into it, how much separation there is between the U.S. and Israel right now, and how much pressure the U.S. is really trying to put on the Israelis. So it was upon that visit this week that the Israelis got a wake-up call, so to speak, when it comes to what they need to do to continue to preserve that relationship with the U.S., the U.S. Obviously giving them aid, giving them weapons, continuing to defend Israel's right to defend itself. But the message from Kamala Harris, apparently to the Israelis, is help us help you by allowing in more humanitarian aid. It came as the U.S. conducted another airdrop of aid into Gaza on Monday, as there continue to be concerns about malnutrition and food shortages for the more than 2 million Palestinians in the Strip. All right, now this from USA Today. The Arctic could be ice-free in the summertime as soon as the next few years. That's according to a new study out on Tuesday. That's the earliest date any study has suggested an ice-free Arctic could occur, as many as 10 years earlier than projections. The thought was not until the late 2030s would we start to see an ice-free summer in the Arctic, and that is happening sooner than expected. Now, the amount of summertime sea ice has been declined for a number of years because of global warming. Now, the definition here of ice-free Arctic summer will occur when the Arctic has less than 386,000 square miles of sea ice. That's how they define this. So they thought it would happen in the 2030s. It will now happen in the 2020s. Sea ice is frozen ocean water that melts each summer and then refreezes each winter. It has been declining for years, especially in September when it reaches its lowest coverage of the year. And this has a huge impact on wildlife up there. Keep in mind, you got polar bears, you got walruses that need a place to walk around and live even in the summer. And so that is a huge issue here, what it means for wildlife up there in the Arctic. And it's also significant because what happens in the Arctic does not stay in the Arctic. It could affect weather patterns here in the U.S. Remember, we get the polar vortex and other systems. And as things warm up there, we're seeing things go totally out of whack and then create weird weather for us, or abnormal weather in Europe, in the U.S., and around the world. Now, some also note that a ice-free Arctic in the summer also makes that area accessible for shipping, mining, and tourism. So they try to look at the positives on the economic front here, but still concerning from scientists, and something we'll keep monitoring here on the pod. All right, this now from Reuters. The latest on the hack of the healthcare systems here in the U.S., now officially 2 weeks since that hack. The U.S. government, the Department of Health and Human Services, yesterday said it will relax certain requirements around Medicare prescriptions and consider advanced payments for struggling healthcare facilities. It's the first major federal government action since the cyber attack hit the back-end systems that are effectively used by most hospitals, pharmacies, and insurance companies to communicate. It's crippled the flow of money through the health system. It's made life difficult for doctors, for patients, for pharmacies, in order to figure out if your insurance will cover things, if they will pay for things. It's made a lot of people have to pay out of pocket for various procedures, and really frozen the financial system. United Health Group owns Optum. They were forced to disconnect over 100 systems from their Change Healthcare unit. That was the unit that was impacted here, that provides that back-end infrastructure after that February 21st ransomware attack. The move has brought insurance payments and other services to a halt here in the U.S. Now, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services said they will assist healthcare providers with switching clearinghouses, switching back-end systems. They will also issue guidance to Medicare Advantage and Part D providers that encourage them to relax prior authorization requirements. And they recommend the same for Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program providers. Those are the CHIP programs. The department also said it'll allow for accelerated payments similar to those they issued back during the pandemic from healthcare organizations. It comes as they've gotten a lot of pressure from the hospitals, from the doctor's offices, to do something here. The American Hospital Association yesterday wrote congressional leaders saying that they need to do something, and they need to begin issuing advance payments to providers to lessen the financial burden they face right now, 2 weeks in. All this, by the way, as we're learning from Wired magazine, that it appears the hackers may have been paid a ransom in the last few days. It's unclear whether this is all of it, some of it, and whether this specifically went to them. But one of the partners of the hackers behind the attack points out that those hackers, a group known as Black Cat or Alpha V, received a $22 million transaction on the Bitcoin public ledger that looks very much like a ransom payment. So Bitcoin is public. It's all a series of numbers and letters. And they've been able to identify that that's an account associated with Black Cat that suddenly received $22 million in the last week. And there have been some hackers that have been touting it on the dark web. The payment was specifically 350 Bitcoins, but that averages to about $22 million right now, given where Bitcoin is. So it's not like Venmo. We can't see who paid them, what it was for, etc. But again, there does appear to have been a payment here to these ransomware attackers. That's, by the way, the essence of what this is. They'll hack a system and say, we're going to keep it locked up and make your life hell unless you pay us off. You pay us a ransom. Now, some companies fight this, figure out how to get their information back without paying a ransom. It appears, though, a ransom may have been paid here, though none of the hospitals or medical companies will admit to that right now. They say we're just focused on the hack. No comment about any sort of payment to the ransomware attackers. Some analysts observing this do note that this could be a dangerous precedent because this will now incentivize hackers to do this more often. By the way, we've already seen this escalating for the past few years, so unclear how much more often they could be doing this since we have seen a exponential growth in the number of hacks in recent years. That said, $22 million would be a significant ransom, and if it was paid, it's unclear whether any systems have been reopened here, but something we're watching, that latest detail coming again from Wired magazine. All right, this next story from the world of college sports from Axios. The men's college basketball team at Dartmouth University has voted to unionize. It's a move that could ultimately really blow up the current model for college athletics. The NCAA has long insisted that college athletes are students, they're amateurs, and do not work for the schools, despite the fact that football and basketball especially make billions of dollars for universities. There has been a push in recent years among students to want a piece of that action, the piece of the millions and billions they're bringing in to their colleges. And so now you see the significant move here by at least the team at Dartmouth to unionize. That was made possible by a recent ruling by the National Labor Relations Board that said players are employees as far as they're concerned. It could upend the whole system. It could open the door even further to college athletes being paid directly. Now, Dartmouth and a whole number of folks are fighting this. Dartmouth has already challenged the basketball team's unionization effort. The Ivy League, which is the conference that Dartmouth is in, the NCAA could also challenge this. So nothing is a done deal here. This could be years of litigation. In fact, the vast majority of the players, in fact, all the players at Dartmouth who are currently there and have voted to unionize, likely will be gone by the time this whole thing is resolved. But certainly a storyline we're watching as college athletes, again, realize how much money they're making for their universities and want a piece of it. All right, and a bit of royal news here as we end the speed read from CBS News. Britain's Catherine, the Princess of Wales, wife of Prince William, was spotted in public on Monday for the first time since she underwent abdominal surgery back in mid-January. That's according to photos from TMZ. Princess Kate, who is 42 and whose husband, Prince William, is the heir to the British throne, son of King Charles, has been at home since January recovering from the abdominal surgery, though they haven't given us details now for months as to what specifically the surgery was about. They've only said it had nothing to do with cancer, but it has led to a lot of speculation. Well, on Monday, she was pictured in a car wearing sunglasses with her mother. It was just her and her mother in the car, unclear where they were headed, no kids, no security. TMZ reported that the photo was taken near Windsor Castle. It is notable, though, because the photos haven't been printed in a lot of outlets. Nearly all British outlets are saying they will not publish these photos because they were taken by paparazzi. A number of American outlets also respecting that. And that is a notable difference from what we saw in recent years, going back to William's mom, Princess Diana, and the paparazzi that would chase her and the photos that were run everywhere. Even Harry and Meghan in recent years saw a lot of paparazzi photos and effectively media publications, both in the UK and the US, run with them. But they are trying, it appears, at least in the case of Princess Kate here, to respect her privacy as she recovers here. But again, a lot of speculation, a lot of mystery regarding this abdominal surgery back in January. No real details provided by the palace. And it came as her father-in-law, King Charles, underwent his own surgery, which they've been more open about, and his cancer diagnosis. Right now, all of her events are canceled through the spring. The palace says she will not be returning to any royal duties before Easter. Right now, there is one event on the agenda in June, the Trooping the Colour annual event. The British Defence Ministry announced that Kate is set to be there. That's set for June 8th. All right, now time for On This Day in History. We begin in the 19th century, back in 1857. On this day, what's considered to be the worst decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in history, the Dred Scott decision. The court voted 7-2 to say that a black slave was not an American citizen because of his race and did not deserve freedom. The ruling effectively stated that African Americans were not and could never become citizens of the United States. The decision added fuel to the controversy, to the divisiveness of that time. Just 4 years later, a little less than 4 years later, we would see the start of the Civil War. Just a few years later, as the Union won and the passage of the 13th and 14th Amendments to the Constitution take place, they abolish slavery, declare all persons born in the U.S. to be American citizens, effectively overturning that decision. On this day in 1899, the German company Bayer, you may have heard of them, they patented aspirin. It was originally made from a chemical found in the bark of willow trees. In its primitive form, the active ingredient was used for centuries in folk medicine, used even as far back as ancient Greece by Hippocrates. They would see people who lived near willow trees take the bark and chew on it as pain relief. And so they were able to take that and turn it into aspirin there in the late 19th century. A Bayer employee named Felix Hoffman found a way to create a stable form of the drug, make it more pleasant to take because in its raw form, it would cause damage to the stomach. Interesting fact, though, it appears that Felix Hoffman, who gets credit officially by Bayer for the work, apparently had a Jewish chemist who did a lot of the work for him named Arthur Eichengrün, whose contributions were covered up during the Nazi era. So interesting history related to Bayer. All right, on this day in 1912, from aspirin to Oreo cookies, on this day, the Oreo, first introduced by the National Biscuit Company. All right, a little sports history here. On this day in 1964, Cassius Clay took the name Muhammad Ali, given to him by his spiritual mentor, Elijah Muhammad, then the leader of the Nation of Islam. All right, and we end here with a little bit of pop culture, as we always do. On this day in 1965, The Temptations score their first number one single in the U.S. with their hit, My Girl. Fast forward 30 years, 1995, Annie Lennox releases her second solo album with the first single, No More I Love Yous. No more I love yous. And a bit of movie history here. I have a few friends that were obsessed with this film. Dan Roush, Shane, Mike Zussel, Jay Stern and company. I'm looking at you. The Big Lebowski, out today in theaters 26 years ago on this day in 1998. All right, I want to thank all of you for joining the Mo News Daily Podcast. If you like what you hear, please share this with your friends, your family, strangers on the street, your colleagues. We appreciate all your support spreading the word about the Mo News Pod. Also, with the social media going down, you want to make sure you're following the pod to get the latest when those other platforms go down. Also, we have the Mo Newsletter over at mo.news/newsletter. So over at mo.news is pretty much where you can get everything. You can join Mo News Premium, where you have access to weekend news coverage, exclusive Q&As, ask me anythings. We're doing meetups now for premium members, including this Friday in Miami. So join Mo News Premium for access to all that. And also as a way to support what we're doing here over at mo.news/premium. It is just $7 a month, basically a cup of coffee once a month to support what we're doing and to get access to a whole lot more here at Mo News. Wishing all of you a great Wednesday. Jill, I hope you're recovering and we'll see you back here tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the Mo News Podcast.